Imagine having every security camera on every street and every bus at your disposal. You'd be able to watch everybody all the time if you wanted. And that Australian technology has already been used to track terrorists. The Science Show on ABC Radio National and online at abc.net.au/rn. Hello, Robin Williams with Houses. How to stop the drafts, save lives and save a fortune. How to save houses from bushfires. And later on we'll have a female icon like no other. Well, Ian Plimer's book Heaven and Earth has been in the bestseller lists for a month. It takes an unusually harsh line on climate change, the received wisdom. This review by Professor Malcolm Walter, University of New South Wales.
At the core of Ian Plimer's book are two propositions. First, that scientists like everyone else can be victims of fashion. And second, that it suits the vested interests of some influential nations to promote knowingly a false belief in anthropogenic climate change. He asserts that the fashion is the acceptance of the reality of anthropogenic climate change. So he takes up the challenge of exploding this scientific myth. It seems that for Plimer, this is like his earlier battle with creation science, where he had a moral victory but lost in court. With his usual panache, he charges into battle, David against the Goliath of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and all its minions and knaves. Plimer has amassed a vast and impressive array of facts, hypotheses and speculations, all documented with hundreds, in fact thousands, of footnote references, and packaged into 503 densely written and sometimes almost unreadable pages. There are long, meandering discourses on irrelevant subjects such as the early evolutionary history of the animals, interspersed with fact-packed pages on the geological and archaeological records of past climate change. There are massive compilations of hugely diverse subjects ranging from the evolution of the universe to the history of grasslands during the Pleistocene glaciations. These compilations demonstrate an enormous amount of work on his part, but many long sections read as little more than lists. There are blatant and fundamental contradictions. We read on page 165 that the proof that carbon dioxide does not drive climate is shown by previous glaciations. Then on page 169 we read, if global volcanicity was reduced, then the amount of carbon dioxide entering the atmosphere would have been less and the planet's atmosphere would have cooled. Either CO2 concentrations affect the climate or they don't. On page 436, Plimer writes of the last century, there has been a rise in CO2, yet cooling is taking place. Yet on page 25, he has a graph showing an overall warming trend, with some fluctuations as would be expected in any complex system. There is fallacious reasoning. Take this statement on page 87. If it is acknowledged that there have been rapid large climate changes before industrialisation, then human production of carbon dioxide cannot be the major driver for climate change. This would only be true if carbon dioxide concentrations were the only driver of climate change, something that no one proposes as far as I know. This level of naivety, if that's what it is, it's hard to comprehend. It is true that prior to Homo sapiens walking the Earth, there were huge fluctuations in climate, far bigger than any contemplated right now. But it is also true that it is widely accepted that many variables caused or contributed to those changes, carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere being just one of the variables. But ultimately, that is irrelevant. The situation now is that on the timescale that matters most to humans, years, generations or centuries, carbon dioxide concentrations are increasing, and that is one of the variables, and probably the major one, driving climate change at present. The fact that variations in the Earth's orbit, variations in the luminosity of the Sun, and many other factors have driven climate change on a geological timescale is cold comfort. We weren't around to be bothered, except for very recent times. And there were no huge cities on coastlines, and no complex economies structured around climate-sensitive agriculture. Sure, mankind survived severe glaciations in the intervening warm periods, but we demanded little of our environment then, and as nomads we could migrate easily. Now we occupy a vastly complex system of our own invention, and that system is very sensitive to perturbations, whether they be influenza epidemics, great wars, global financial crises, or climate change. we would be irresponsible fools not to attempt to mitigate the effects of these noxious perturbations. An analogy might be helpful. We unwittingly damage the atmosphere by releasing chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, from refrigerators and other sources for decades until 1989. That caused the ozone hole in the southern hemisphere and increased the risk of skin damage and cancer. Once it was recognised, global action was agreed and taken. It shows that even relatively small human actions can seriously perturb the atmosphere. Plimer has to be admired for attempting to gather together and summarise the vast amount and range of science. It's a daunting task. The book may well be a useful source of references for those who wish to delve deeply into this subject. But my overall impression is that he bit off more than he can chew. There is a mass of only partly digested material and poorly expressed interpretations. Severe editing would have helped keep the message clear and well-reasoned, and he was not well-served in that regard. This book matters, partly because the public understanding of science is limited. We don't attempt to measure that understanding in Australia, but it has been done in the US and Europe for 50 years or so, where the proportion of people with a fair level of scientific understanding is estimated at 28% in the US and 14% in Europe. The Australian public probably lies somewhere in this range. It seems to be poorly understood that science advances by challenging accepted interpretations and demanding new evidence. Disputes are a normal part of our business. But because of poor understanding of the process of science, healthy disputation can be misinterpreted in the public and by journalists. Contrarians like Plimer can be seen as saints resisting evil, and the IPCC can be portrayed as a giant conspiracy. I think Plimer is entirely sincere in his efforts to argue against anthropogenic climate change, but he is misguided, and his interpretation of the literature is confused. Why do I have any credibility on this issue? Like Plimer, I'm a geologist, with a very long experience in basic fieldwork. I have particular experience in working on the evidence for severe glaciations in the past, and on understanding the early history of the Earth. I'm also a planetary scientist with an interest in other planets in the solar system, including their climates. Reviewing this book has been an unpleasant experience for me. I've been a friendly colleague of Plimer's for 25 years or more. I admired his support for innovative geological research during his early career as a mineral explorer in industry. I cheered him on when he took on the so-called creation scientists and their bogus nonsense, a crusade that cost him dearly in the end. I have enjoyed his always lively and entertaining lectures. But this time, in my opinion, he has done a disservice to science and to the community at large.
Professor Malcolm Walter from the University of New South Wales. He was reviewing Ian Plimer's book, Heaven and Earth. Another review here next week. And you can hear Kurt Lambeck, the president of the Australian Academy of Science, take a look at it in this week's Occam's Razor. Winter began this week here in the south. The chill was already apparent and the heaters went on. But what if you'd insulated your house? Do you realise that energy saving could be colossal and you'd even save lives? This is Professor of Public Health Philippa Howden-Chapman in Wellington.
Well, largely in New Zealand we have villas, we think we're in Italy, and bungalows, we think we're in India, but actually we're in a temperate climate. In a temperate climate with very high rainfall and strong prevailing westerly winds. The combination of these things means that our temperature is about 16, and lots of parts of the country get down much lower than that. And yet our houses, which are some of the largest in the OECD, built largely of wood, they're very drafty, and as the price of electricity has gone up, we can't afford to heat them properly. And so we're realising that there's quite a strong health effect of living in a cold, large, drafty house.
What made them build houses like that way back in the old days? Was it simply copying the home country, Europe?
Yes, we imported, first of all, our plans from England. So they almost the houses actually faced south because that was where the sun came from in the northern hemisphere. And then we switched to America, and quite a lot of our house plans come from California-style bungalows. But actually, they're not very good indigenous architecture. We would have been better following some of the Māori designs of housing, which were dug into the earth more or had much better insulation than actually the old wooden houses in New Zealand did. But there was a plentiful supply of wood, so it was wood that we got.
What sort of health effects are there Seems obvious, but have you examined what people do when they're living for a long time in these great big drafty cold houses?
Yes, we've done quite a lot of work on this. One of the first areas that we looked at is the number of people who were dying in winter rather than summer, what we call the excess winter mortality, and found to our shock and surprise that it was very high in New Zealand. 1,600 people die each year over and above the amount that you would expect in the winter, three winter months. And we share this phenomenon of temperate countries with Scotland and Portugal. And curiously, it doesn't occur in Canada, even in Siberia. In those countries, the housing is much better built, much better heated, and people wear more appropriate clothing. Here we underestimate the effects of climate, and our houses do not seem to protect us from winter conditions. So that's one thing. People are dying, and it's been unchanged for 20 years. In countries like Finland and Netherlands, which have upgraded their houses, this excess winter mortality entirely disappears. But more particularly, we're concerned about the amount of illness that this might be occurring, and we've pioneered in New Zealand what we're quite proud of, which is doing community trials. We get a large number of people help us, working with about 3,000 families at the moment. First of all, we insulated standard New Zealand bungalows and villas, and they were houses in which somebody had a respiratory problem, and we carried out a randomised community trial and found that when we insulated the houses in the intervention group, that this not only lowered the amount of energy that people used by about a quarter, but it reduced the number of days they had off school, reduced their number of hospitalizations, and generally made them feel healthier and increased their well-being. And we did a cost-benefit study of this. It showed a 2-to-1 benefit over cost, and it's had quite an impact on the government because it was seen to be something that increased energy efficiency, improved health, and of course is one of the most cost-effective things that you can do to mitigate climate change. Insulating houses is the most cost-effective thing, in fact, in most of the analyses that are done. So we had these three benefits. The previous government in New Zealand put up a household fund, $1 billion, very similar to what Mr Rudd is doing in Australia, of insulating all the homes for much the same reason. And Barack Obama has his weatherisation program as a driver of sustainability, because of course it also employs a lot of people, and we work very closely with the district health boards in New Zealand, with the city councils, where people get together and say, as a regional initiative, we'll insulate 10,000 homes in Taranaki or 1,000 homes in the Wairarapa. And so going out, giving talks and encouraging them. So this is where we're doing quite interesting, I think. It's an example where we've shown that not only are people more likely to die because of the quality of homes, we've shown that insulating quite a modest retrofit into the home can improve their health and well-being, and that heating also improves their well-being and means that children with asthma, who were the main focus of that study, those children had 2 days more at school than the children who didn't have their homes insulated and had old-fashioned kind of heating, like which was just a plug-in electric heater or unflued gas heaters.
Well, obviously, the scale of the improvement that you describe, all those figures, very, very impressive. You talked about going out into the public and speaking. What sort of reactions do you get when you're face-to-face with people talking about this sort of thing, such as insulation?
One of the conferences that I spoke at, one of the Māori community workers had designed a T-shirt which said, "It's the nicest thing that's ever happened to me." And it was that somebody had insulated their house, you know, for $2,000. So it's very touching. And some of these big community meetings where, you know, 10,000 homes in Taranaki, I think about them as religious revival meetings almost. They have somebody who speaks about, you know, what my home's like, and that my child has to go into hospital for asthma 3 times before this happened, and now we're all well, we can use the whole house rather than being together and crowded in one room.
I wonder whether there would be, on the other hand, a certain amount of scepticism. You're going into people's houses, almost like the nanny state interfering. Do you get some people saying, "Go away"?
Well, we did get a lot of discussion about nanny state as part of our election last year, which I always thought as an aside, was somewhat curious, as it was a class-based metaphor from Britain, and you could count on the number of two hands in New Zealand how many people had nannies. But that aside, no, this was an area that we deliberately chose because everybody has a house. Everybody has a home unless you're homeless. So people saw that this was very important. And while it seemed very commonsensical that your home should be warm and dry without mould, people recognised that we needed to quantify the effect size. So people have been extremely positive about it. So I would say, in fact, the only negative feeling is, did we have to do research to show what was obvious?
Yes. What do the engineers say? Presumably you're talking to the building people about what's practical. Do they say the sky's the limit or what?
Well, one of the exciting things about the research that I do is it's a very multidisciplinary team. So I'm a social scientist myself, but I work with doctors and respiratory physicians. But we have engineers as part of our group, architects and physicists. So it's been said that to really have an impact, you need engineers, witnesses and storytellers. So we try and do both, mainly community trials in our group, but we also have adjunct qualitative work. And sometimes it's those stories that really can persuade politicians that this should be a policy development around there. For example, the cost of insulating the house is exactly the same cost, coincidentally, as one inpatient night in a hospital. And so insulating a house is an intervention that lasts for about 30 years. There's, you know, most families stay about 10 years in a house, so there's going to be, you know, 30, 40, 50 people living in that house. You've only got to stop one of them having an avoidable hospitalisation, and you've saved the money of insulating houses. Now, I've started to hear that back from taxi drivers, and you hear it on talkback radio, so you think that viral message of actually talking about if we can just improve our housing, it will have a benefit on health and will lower those big increase in hospital bills in the middle of winter. And people start to see that that makes a common sense, that even though your home is your castle, the quality of our housing actually has public consequences.
Professor Philippa Howden-Chapman at the University of Otago in Wellington, New Zealand, where she runs the Centre for Sustainable Cities. Here in Australia, we have, as part of the Energy Efficient Homes Package, a sum of $1,600 for owner-occupiers and $1,000 for eligible landlords. These grants cover about 2.9 million Australian homes. Links on the Science Show website.
Fires across Victoria have now killed at least 131 people, destroyed 700 homes, and burnt out more than 350,000 hectares.
The fires across Victoria in February. Time and again, in New South Wales and Queensland, even in Tasmania, homes burn down. But what if we could protect them? Gwion Kane has one scheme that might work, and he's tried for ages to get authorities to take it seriously. He's a builder living outside Cairns in northern Queensland.
I think not being an engineer sometimes puts you in a simpler direction where some people tend to complicate it. And looking at the patents through the world, when I put the patent application in, it was very much the case. A lot of the designs that have been put in are actually extremely complicated and far too expensive and not operable.
OK, so what's the basis of yours?
The basis of ours is really a tent. It's a high tensile strength fabric made out of silica, which is sand, £260 per square inch. And the key to it is a water pod, which is like a sausage sleeve around the base of the tent, which is filled up by the fire brigade and holds the pod down. So whether you have concrete, grass, fencing, doesn't matter what base you have around your house, it will anchor this to the ground.
I see. So when the fire is coming, what you essentially do is stick this tent over the top and that protects it.
That's correct.
Now, you said how many pounds per square inch? I mean, that sounds very heavy.
No, that's the tensile strength, not the
weight. Oh, I see, the tensile strength, not the weight. OK.
The weight of the unit on the average size house of 16 squares would be around the 40 kilos.
That's manageable. I see. Now, what if, imagine that you're in one of the towns in Victoria and you hear a very fast fire is coming, how much time do you have to put this tent over your house?
We perceive that the fire brigade and the calculation tests that we've done and the research and development engineer has done, we believe you should be able to fill the pods up in about 10 minutes. And the whole thing should take between 20 minutes and half an hour.
I don't quite see how it works. If I'm standing at the base of my house and I want to get something over the house, a helicopter fine, but how else do you get it over the top?
Okay, the fabric's actually quite lightweight. There's actually a catapult system where you catapult fine lines across the top of the house and you can actually drag it over the house. There are certain situations with designs of houses, obviously, where you'll have to get on the roof to pull them over certain ridges and things like that. But that's a situation where, obviously, because every house is different, you're going to have to put these implementations in place and work out what you need to do to get it over the roof. But yes, there is a propulsion system that pulls it over.
Is it all in one go and then it's over? In other words, can you practice using it and put it back like you would a parachute re-rolled into the bag?
Absolutely. You can test and test and test so you can get good at doing it. Yes, absolutely.
And what about when it's happened, if you've heard the warning, you've put the tent over the house, do you stay in the house safely?
These are the tests that we've got to do. We've got to ascertain what sort of level of heat is going to be generated within. There is a thermal burn-off with this fabric. It's a one-use unit, so that once the fire has come over, it does burn into the fabric. So we need to see what sort of level of thermal capacity this fabric has. It does have a thermal capacity, so we need to know how hot it gets. There is a pressure relief valve on the unit as well to prevent negative vacuum. So they're one of the tests that we have to do in order to ascertain whether people can be inside there or not.
But and breathe as well.
And breathe, exactly. But the idea was to design four standard units for housing that can be sold at, say, Mitre 10, Home Hardware, etc., so people can buy them. And also standard units to be put over cars, boats, and also the tests that need to be done are over for fire engines. So to put them over the fire trucks and then allow the firemen to sit inside with their oxygen units.
Well, it sounds intriguing, and as you say, it's made of silicate, and that's a commonly available material. You've got an amount of testing to do, but you've sent out a patent. How much good reaction have you had, first of all, from the experts? What do they say?
Well, CSIRO, the Bush Fire Department, when they looked at the unit, said it was the most promising unit they'd seen in 10 years. Other people have had good response from it, but we did actually get funding at one point during the Gulf War, full funding, and the company that were willing to fund it were actually a weapons manufacturing company, and they went straight into they dropped it and went straight into weapons manufacture.
So you haven't, in fact, gone further forward technically. What about the authorities, the people who could actually make it happen? What do they say?
It's a very sticky situation. The previous government basically just kept passing me through from department to department. No feedback was given. With the present government, I have sent various letters to the departments, and again, I'm just getting passed to department to department. The amount of funding that we're requesting to finish the research to produce a finished saleable product is very small. The fabric that we're using is actually a fully patented, tested fabric that's used by the Ministry of Defence, used by London Underground in all the seating in the London Underground trains. It's used by the military for the MASH tents as a liner for their tents in case of go up in flames. As I said, the physical testing that has to be done is purely a wind tunnel test, really, because all the testing for the actual fabric has been done and does have all the stamps that are required in order for it to be passed.
And I'd imagine to have models or even animals to make sure that people don't get parboiled in the process while they're under wraps if they happen to stay.
That's correct. I mean, the tests that are required, according to CSIRO, when I've spoken to them, basically all we have to do is put together a false wall of a house. You don't even need to put a whole house together. You need to have a wall of a house with all the relevant materials that are used in housing, place a drape of the actual fabric over that, and then produce a high fire situation and have all the testing equipment on there. That's what CSIRO will do. So the situation is with the government is that they have the testing facilities. We're not asking for cash. We're asking for help to actually get this on the market. We're not looking for financial gain as such. We just want to see this thing in operation. The CSIRO have no funding of their own. They would love to see it implemented. So they have the testing facilities. It's purely for the government to supply us with those testing facilities to make it work.
And if you imagine if it were produced, have you got any estimate of what it would cost a householder?
We estimate between $7,000 and $10,000. But we put together a system to finance this. And the idea was that any new house put together would be supplied with one, but also put to one of the insurance companies, I won't give a name out now, but that the best way forward would be to supply an insurance policy with your household insurance, that if your house should go up in flames, you can rent one of these blankets from, say, a plant hire company that would hold them. You rent the blanket, the insurance company pays $2,500 to the plant hire company in order to supply it. If the blanket is used, the insurance company then pay the plant hire company a further $7,500 for the cost of the blanket. Plant hire company make $2,500 for the unit. And essentially, it's a win-win situation because the insurance company, it's cost them $10,000 instead of $380,000, which is the average price of a house.
Guyon Kane, who's a builder with me in Cairns, northern Queensland, it could work. We shall see. This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National, and on this program, over the years, I've often mentioned the name of the youngest person ever to win a Nobel Prize for Science, the young fellow from Adelaide, Lawrence Bragg. But who's the oldest science laureate to reach great age and still do important work? Her name is Rita Levi Montalcini, and she's a role model like no other. And she's 100. This tribute by Lynn Beasley.
Levi Montalcini celebrated her birthday in characteristic style. Totally elegant and intellectually sharp as many tacks. Her scientific achievements are amazing, but no less amazing is her real life story. Her motto is, "You shouldn't fear difficult moments. The best comes from them." One of four children born into a loving and traditional Jewish family in Turin, her first of the many difficult moments was her father's objection to women pursuing careers. But she won him over and graduated in medicine from the University of Turin, specializing in neurology and psychiatry. The next difficult moment ended a brief appointment in Belgium when the Germans invaded in 1940 and she fled back to Italy. But not to a welcome reception, as fascist laws prevented Jews from practicing medicine or working in universities. This might have deterred most of us, but not the young Levi Montalcini. She went underground, setting up laboratories in her bedroom, and continued her research on development of the chick nervous system. In this, she was inspired by the research of an American neuroembryologist, destined later to become a close friend and colleague, Victor Hamburger. The Allied armies arrived in 1944, and Levi Montalcini resumed her work as a medical doctor. She worked in a refugee camp, putting her own life on the line, as she treated thousands with highly contagious diseases such as typhoid and cholera. With the end of the war, the family returned to Turin, where Levi Montalcini joined the staff of the university. Then, out of the blue, came an invitation to join Victor Hamburger in Washington University in St. Louis. She planned to stay for only 10 months, but stayed for 30 years before returning to her homeland. Hamburger's observation in chick embryos had triggered her own work into the death of immature nerve cells if they are deprived of their target, the developing limb. When Hamburger and Levi Montalcini teamed up, their first move was to follow up their earlier studies and replace the limb bud by another tissue and see what happened. They tried a seemingly unlikely tissue from mouse sarcoma, a tumour of connective tissue, following up clues from other work in their faculty. It was a great choice. Nerve fibres grew into the sarcoma and parent nerve cells grew up to 6 times their normal size. The sarcoma tissue must have been chock-a-block with something that nerve cells really liked. They came up with the same result when the sarcoma was placed at a distance from the limb, showing that the signal was a diffusible substance that could reach the nerve cell bodies via the bloodstream. At this point, the story moves briefly to South America and from living animals to tissue culture. Levi Montalcini took 2 sarcoma-affected mice, nestled in her handbag, to Rio de Janeiro to conduct a crucial study using techniques developed there. The outcome was sensational. Levi-Montalcini watched as the clump of immature nerve cells grew a halo of nerve fibers, which was most dense towards the sarcoma cells. It was even clearer evidence for a diffusible nerve growth factor. To quote Levi-Montalcini, "The discovery was the highlight of my life. I immediately understood its importance. I was opening up a whole new scenario." So what was that scenario? It was that, against accepted dogma, the development of the brain, with all its exquisite complexity, is not rigidly controlled and is not exclusively predetermined by genes to be read out in an autonomous way. Rather, brain development is an interactive sequence of events, with feedback to keep some nerve cells alive and steer their nerve fibers to their correct locations. At the same time, other nerve cells do not receive the right signals and die. Indeed, we now know that up to half the nerve cells produced do not survive brain development, and the brain couldn't function properly if they did. Back to the Levi-Montalcini story, and back from Rio, the hunt was on for the structure of the nerve growth factor. Levi-Montalcini sought the help of Stanley Cohen, a biochemist, a few rooms away. They needed first to find a tissue that was a good source of the mysterious factor. They found it in moderate amounts in snake venom, and after a systematic search, hit the jackpot in the salivary gland of the male mouse. Although to this day we do not know why the mouse produces so much of this particular factor when other animals do not. The protein nerve growth factor was sequenced, and Stanley Cohen went on to discover epidermal growth factor. He shared the Nobel Prize with Levi-Montalcini in 1986. So what's happened since the Nobel Prize-winning discoveries? Today we know of many families of growth factors in the nervous system. They hold the key to cell survival or cell death of many nerve cells, with different growth factors specific to particular parts of the brain. Growth factors are also likely to prove a key part of therapies for recovery from brain injury or diseases such as Parkinson's. For example, scientists are genetically engineering stem cells to produce growth factors with the aim of aiding cell survival and encouraging the cells to grow appropriate nerve connections. In addition, nerve growth factor has been implicated in Alzheimer's disease. We all keenly await the day when neuroscientists can turn Levi-Montalcini's discoveries into clinical treatments. On a lighter note, nerve growth factor levels are said to rise when people fall in love and stay high for about the first year of a relationship. Growth factors are also now known to exist in a multitude of tissues beyond the nervous system, some stimulating cell production, others leading to cell death. For example, they control the rate of production of red and white blood cells and are involved in wound healing. But with all these achievements, is Levi-Montalcini resting on her laurels? Certainly not. She still works every day. She supervises research, is an ambassador of the United Nations campaigning against world hunger, and has established a foundation that has already given 7,000 African women access to education. As if this wasn't enough, in 2001 she was appointed a senator for life by the President of the Italian Republic. It is a role she takes very seriously, and she's been a constant thorn in the side of the right wing of Italian politics. So what is Levi-Montalcini's secret of long life and her tremendous vitality? She told the press on her 100th birthday, "No food, no husband, and no regrets." Wow. Whatever her formula, I do know that Rita Levi-Montalcini is one amazing lady. The science community salutes you and wishes you many more productive years.
And the same from us. the retirement age has just moved to 110. That tribute came from our own female role model, Professor Lyn Beazley, herself a nerve researcher and chief scientist of Western Australia. Yes, you're being watched, but you knew that. However, the game's got to a whole new dimension. Meet Professor Svetha Venkatesh at Curtin University in Perth. She's already been brought in by the British police to identify those involved in the London terrorist bombings.
Yes, so we work in what I call large-scale pattern recognition. That is, the data can come from different types of sensors. It can be from a camera, or it can be from a microphone, or it could even just be text data. And our algorithms try to find out what is so-called normal in the data, that is what is happening most of the time, and through that try to detect what is abnormal. So for example, we've looked at graffiti detection on buses by embedding a small audio microphone in the pane of the glass so that when people do graffiti, we learn the normal noises that you have in a bus, and when people do graffiti, then it's of course recognized as an anomaly and can alert the transport people immediately.
So what happens? There is the sound and a little machine goes off somewhere and they think our bus number 49C has got some vandals on it. Do they rush out immediately, or is it a more general test?
Well, it's technically supposed to be rush out immediately. It's supposed to be SMS to the transit police, and then they can either follow the bus, or at least they know which bus. They have the video footage, and then they can basically apprehend the criminals.
Talking about buses, what about that detection that you did in the London event?
Yeah, what we did there was, when the London bombing happened, one of the questions that was asked was, did the bomber get off the bus? And really, it could not be answered for about 2 weeks or so, because although in every bus there is a front-facing camera and the video footage gets recorded on the bus, and the bus that actually exploded, you could actually see that bus from other buses, so technically the footage was there. But it could not be taken off the bus for about 2 weeks because you had to physically go to the bus, take the hard disks out, and people had to manually look at it to find that event, which is, of course, very late. So what we did is we teamed up with a local company who installed the cameras on board buses, and we basically then treat this network of moving cameras as if it was a big camera, so to speak. And then using that, we constructed this concept of virtual observer, which means that anywhere along this network of buses, wherever the buses go, you can create an artificial camera anywhere in that network. So what you can say is, okay, at this place, at this time, show me all the footage. So effectively what it does for you automatically is take out the bits of footage from different buses that pass that point in that spot in time and place, and present it to you as if it's a single piece of footage in time. So the advantage of this is, A, you can construct limitless numbers of cameras. It's not physical infrastructure. It's just using the infrastructure that exists right now, and it's untapped in most cities. Like, these front-facing cameras are there in Los Angeles, in LA. Now they're going to be in Queensland. We have them in Perth. They're in many, many cities. And basically using that infrastructure to create infrastructure for police for wide area surveillance. And now it's also going to be used by councils for asset management. So, for example, if you're a council and you want to see what's happening on the verge, we're putting it on rubbish trucks. So the rubbish trucks go past even the suburban areas. And so you'll be able to look at a property for valuation or any other kinds of complaints that they may have had about that property. So it basically allows you to tap this very interesting mobile infrastructure and create a wide area solution for a city.
I can understand that you're getting lots of pictures combining in that way. But when it goes back to that person coming off the bus, having got all your different images and put them together, surely the whole thing about someone getting off the bus is it doesn't break the pattern. It's not unusual. It's a very common thing. So it wouldn't stand out.
Right, that's correct. So in the case of that bomber getting off the bus, you could not have spotted it by saying, get me an unusual event. But what you could have done is said, have a camera artificially set up there at that point in time, and it would have done it for you automatically. In the next 5 minutes, you would have had the footage. And if you had had internet access for those buses, you could have got it instantly. right? And whoever got off the bus would have been in a small radius, and then you could look at the bus that was down the street, and you can pretty much follow a person around a city by looking at the network of the buses in whose footage you are.
So that really means that Spooks is true. You know, when you see Howard tapping into his machine and he's looking not just for video cameras or CDC cameras, which might be anywhere, and seeing whether that camera can tell you what's going on, he's got control of almost the whole of any big city and can home in just like it does in the movies.
Well, technically, luckily, the infrastructure is not that good. We don't have infrastructure so that we can automatically take things off buses right now. But the infrastructure exists now, the technology exists now, and at least for things in which privacy is protected. It is important to note that this is not footage that's just released to anybody. It's accessed by the police, who would access that footage anyway, or it's accessed by the asset manager, for example, a council, who would access that footage anyway. So there's a privacy-preserving component in this technology, because of who uses that technology. It's not like Google Earth that anybody can sort of tap in and start to watch somebody moving through a city.
That's a relief. What has this technology got to do with autism?
On the face of it, nothing. But if you look underneath it, one of the components that underlies all our technologies is machine learning. And in machine learning, one of the fundamental components of trying to make a machine, if you like, learn, is a model for what is normal and therefore find out what is abnormal, is to present it with stimulus or what we call training data. So you present it many examples and show the machine what is normal so that it can make a model. Now, with autistic children, one of the methods of early intervention also involves presenting stimulus in a very small and incremental and direct way. So what we are trying to do is using some of the techniques that we've learned from presenting stimulus to machines to try to construct early intervention technologies for children with autism. And the advantage of doing this algorithmically is that it should be possible to present a stimulus with much more variation and therefore prevent overlearning on a particular type of stimulus. So it's very early days, but I think that this is a very interesting and exciting piece of research that we're doing.
Have you tried it with autistic children already?
We're just in the process of getting our ethics clearance, and we're hopefully going to form some partnerships with people who work with autistic children, because we're a computer science department. So in the next couple of months, we should be starting to work with autistic children. But the people who guide us right now have autistic children.
And they're responding enthusiastically, the kids I mean. Svetha Venkatesh is Distinguished Professor at Curtin University in Perth, and the brains behind the Spooks, the real Spooks, that is. Computers being clever, but they can also be very stupid and lose stuff, stuff you want to preserve. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
It's quite alarming to discover that the Doomsday Book, written on sheepskin back in 1086, has outlasted today's British government records by a very long way. More than 1,000 years after it was written, we can still go and see it in its original form. But modern digital government records from only 10 years ago are now unreadable, because it seems a decade is a very long time in computing.
It's a little bit like climate change, in that we know it's bad, but we haven't quite seen the emergency problems coming up yet. And by the time someone gets around to doing something, it will be too late and we will have lost a lot of data.
King's College London's Simon Tanner.
That's why we might talk about this in terms of a digital dark age, where we may look back at this last decade and say, we don't know anywhere near as much about it as we should do, because so much more of the communication of cultural meaning and technical information has been made in an electronic form, but then it was ephemeral, it was lost and it died very quickly because we didn't preserve it, we didn't take care of it.
Mr. Speaker, on Iraq, I believe the prevailing mood of the British people is sound. They do not doubt that Saddam is a brutal dictator, but they suspect that they're being pushed too quickly into conflict by a US administration with an agenda of its own. Yeah. It is for that reason, and with a heavy heart, that I've resigned from the government. Yeah.
That's an excerpt from a speech in the lead-up to the Iraq War in 2003, one of Parliament's most famous. Politician Robin Cook died unexpectedly 2 years later.
We archived Robin Cook, the MP's website, just after he died. That website no longer exists. If we hadn't done that, nobody would have access to the information, the photographs, the interviews on that site.
Stephen Burry is in charge of the British Library's web archiving programme.
There are 7.2 million UK domain websites. At the moment, we're collecting selectively around about 7,000 websites, so that's a very small proportion, and we're very conscious that we're losing things.
You have a practical problem of obtaining permission from the people responsible for the sites you're trying to preserve.
Yeah, everybody imagines the problem's technical. I think all technical things can be overcome. The problem is legal deposit regulation, giving us a right to take these sites without having to ask for permission. The first stage is selection. We then program the web curator tool to visit that site and to take it. And we can adjust the crawls of a particular site. We could do it, if need be, every day. On average, we're doing 3 or 4 instances a year of a site.
So it's like a snapshot every so often as you've decided to take one.
Yes.
Which is then archived.
Yes, that's precisely what it does. It's a snapshot of the site at a particular stage.
Simon Tanner.
At this moment in time, most of the web archiving activity is only able to take a snapshot, a moment in time, at a relatively infrequent period and not to repeat as frequently as one might like to do. So there's issues of how do you get a very wide coverage and how do you get a very deep coverage. And so it's likely that for the foreseeable future we will just be getting a partial view. But that is much better than nothing at all. And at the moment, in some countries and for some types of internet resources, we are getting nothing at all.
Both agree it's the storage of the deep web or the dark web that's the toughest technical challenge. Those are the huge data sets that we don't see, which work together to serve up the information we want at the time we need it. Finding ways around that holds the key to more thorough digital archiving. And making sure all national digital archives are singing from the same songbook and using common tools for preservation and public access.
At the moment, with the speed of technology development and software development, we're seeing the ways that we're accessing information through our computers becoming obsolete very quickly. I'm just wondering how confident you are that what's being developed now is not going to be obsolete in 10, maybe 15 years' time.
I don't think I am confident as the answer. I think that it's a technological challenge going along. And in 1996, we wouldn't have envisaged sort of Web 2.0, blogs and wikis, YouTube. So, yes, these websites are moving towards web applications, and I think that is a challenge. We'll get around that, but there'll be another challenge after those.
Simon Tanner again.
I don't know if we can avoid needing to take continuous action. The thing with digital information is if I write something onto a CD, a rewritable CD, and I put it on my windowsill, it's got a lifetime maybe of 2 months, depending on how hot my windowsill is. And so I need to have a good environment for storing my data, and that's hopefully going to be on sort of managed server environments where the data is being refreshed and kept and backed up in a very effective and continuous manner.
How do we know that we're not just going to be changing everything into new formats every 10 years?
I think that we're seeing slightly more stability in the way that people are using digital information. The requirement to change your computer every 6 months merely to get it to work with different types of information has kind of gone away. There are people surfing the internet on computers they bought in the 1990s. We were finding that we were having to change file formats or move on to new versions every 6 months or every year. And now we're finding that that's starting to stretch to 3 years and 5 years for certain types of file formats, particularly image file formats. We need to get over the issue that digital is significantly different from paper. It is a carrier of human knowledge, and as such, memory organisations should have the ability to store and preserve that for future access.
Maintaining any historical archives is a complicated and ongoing process. But as we all start to get to grips with the short lifespan of our MP3s, all our internet activity, our digital family snaps, and our backed-up data on writable CDs, maybe these particularly modern challenges with digital archiving will become clearer to us all, and the implications of losing it all for eternity. This is Naomi Fowler in London for The Science Show.
Thanks, Naomi. And 20 years after the internet was invented, we still have work to do. But here on The Science Show, we go to extreme lengths to keep you posted on things to come. Here, we eavesdrop on a senior management briefing on how it's all going to pan out.
I hate computers.
You had a bad day at work then?
All the computers were down. It was chaos.
Relax. Computers are on the way out. In the future, people will be working with super intelligent bacteria, much more reliable.
You think so?
It's inevitable. Everything will be better in the future.
Do you think we'll finally see the paperless office?
That's going too far. What with hot desking and working from home, it'll be more the case of the officeless paper.
What about libraries? What will happen to my job at the library?
The library as we know it now, a building with books and computers, that will disappear. Everything will be digitised, nanotechnology will step in, and hey presto, the library of the future will be a small device inserted into the left nostril. Much more convenient.
I thought as much. So I'll be on the dole.
No, there'll be a new job for you. Something more in keeping with your natural instincts to seek and destroy.
I'd like a job with a smart uniform.
In the future, there'll be a great need for environmental cleansing operatives. Pollution won't be tolerated. All the mess will be cleaned up.
Environmental cleansing operative? Sounds well paid.
There'll be danger money, that's for sure, and you'll have to be changed.
Changed? You mean trained?
Of course you'll be trained. But on top of that, it'll be necessary to modify your forehead.
Go on.
The job of an environmental cleansing operative will be to go through old deserted cities, looking for contamination hotspots, feral waste, you know, general pestilence.
To do that, I'd want a really nice uniform.
Well, what you'll get is two new appendages on your forehead. Antennae, like sensory receptors. They'll help you find the stuff.
I'm not sure about appendages.
Don't worry. They'll be only 45 centimetres long.
OK, I'll take it. I hate to be idle.
Good. I'm sure you'll find it very rewarding.
Well, that's me sorted. What about you? What sort of work will you be doing in the future?
To be honest, I'm not sure. I'm not like you. I'm more of a thinker than a worker. I'm hoping to get a doctor's certificate that says not fit for future work.
Some things never change.
Especially in management. Laura Molino and friend, both consultants, of course. Next week on The Science Show, a tribute to this man, only 90, but influencing our lives as never before.
I try to look at the Earth as if it were a living organism. I don't mean it's something that can reproduce itself or live in the ordinary sense, but at least it's capable of regulating itself, keeping its temperature constant, keeping its chemical composition constant. And to that extent, it's alive. It isn't just a ball of rock that responds to, shall we say, an increase in the sun's output of heat by getting hotter. It'll respond by changing the kind of life that's on it to try and keep itself constant, just in the same way as if I came down to the middle of your Australian summer, I'd start sweating and try and keep my internal temperature the same as it is.
Jim Lovelock, father of Gaia, to be discussed by his biographer, John Gribbin. Also, the world without us humans, what it might be like on a planet devoid of people. And on Catalyst, don't miss Jonica Newby's amazing Tracking Gravity Probe B, out there to check whether Einstein was actually right. Catalyst on ABC One, 8 o'clock next Thursday evening. The Science Show is produced by Nikki Phillips, David Fisher, with Charlie McCune on hardware. I'm Robin Williams.
From the 1st of July, the rollout of digital radio in Australia begins. Radio National starts in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth. All you'll need is a digital radio. More stations, pause and rewind of live radio, on-screen information, great sound and easy tuning. Digital radio's coming July the 1st. Find out more at abc.net.au/digitalradio.